there. This is the 149th episode of Radio Free Nintendo. This is Greg sitting in for Johnny, who is once again on his perhaps annual trip to Bonnaroo.
Freaking Bonnaroo. That's all everyone talks about.
If that sounds like an ill omen,
it is.
It's because when this happened last year, Stan and Carl came on the show, and what ensued has never been forgotten, really. So, but we have a far more sort of ordinary show, but nonetheless excellent, hopefully. Because I'm glad to welcome back, first of all, newlywed and site director John Lindemann.
A pleasure, of course.
Good having you back. It's been quite a while.
Yeah, I know.
Since the E3 prediction show, so yeah. Good to catch up. Exhausted features editor, James Jones.
Always exhausted. Always features editor.
And always bitter. Just like this beer.
And that was the lovely tones of Radio Trivia host, Michael TYP Cole, who is back in the States now, fully repatriated.
Yeah, he had a great acclimation period of return E3.
Yeah, like I deferred my jet lag for a week. So after E3, I was up till 4, then sleeping till 4.
It's good fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
But Greg's not bitter, though. That's the thing.
No, I'm absolutely not bitter, not at all. It's the NFL is to blame.
Oh, don't get started. Brett Favre's coming back, buddy.
Oh, you had to bring Brett into this.
I had to go there.
No, we're not. I'm not dignified. It's bad enough that he gets on the cable the sports news all the time. We're not bringing Brett into this, at least not until he's actually something to talk
about. I'm coming back.
Right, so let's get on with it. And the first thing I want to do is thank all the team that went to E3 for doing an absolutely bang-up job. We had the daily podcast with our old host, Carl Castaneda, providing the production on that. And, of course, all the great writing that went on in very prolific bunches of impressions. And I want to TYP, in particular, best abstract of the show. Please continue.
Very good.
You're welcome. I was a big Cinema Punishment
fan.
Please
continue.
I appreciate that a lot. But yeah, it was really, really outstanding stuff from the guys over there, and they covered E3 really well. So we're not going to spend a lot of time on it in this episode by any means, but I do really want to hear from what John made of it from his honeymoon.
God.
Yeah, which everybody kept reminding me of.
Yeah,
you're welcome. So,
yeah, what John stepped up and edited my thoroughly relevant third quarter European release schedule from his honeymoon. This is dedication right there.
Well, it was funny. Your email went out and you were like, I know this really isn't that important, but if somebody could please edit it, I'd appreciate it. So it kind of tugged at my heartstrings a little bit. So
Did you edit it from your cell phone? Because that would have been impressive.
No, we actually had internet access at the hotel.
Oh,
crappy access, but we did have internet access.
Oh, could not have been as bad as our E3 internet access at the hotel.
It's like, well, it'll be better when we get to the hotel. No, it wasn't.
Yeah, it was almost like I was at E3 with the crappy internet access. So
you got the E3 experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you were able to follow it pretty closely, obviously.
Yeah.
What was your gut reaction from Nintendo's conference announcements?
I mean, I really liked it. I mean, I really appreciate it. I mean, I think it was it's interesting seeing kind of like the gut reaction. It really depends on where you're looking. I read the one article where they traced the reaction of NeoGAF posters.
Oh yeah.
And that was pretty funny. But I really liked it.
No, the best part of that was the minute Cammy came on stage, it nosedove.
Well, the funniest thing was that graph is completely, you can just predict it. It's like Cammy down,
Reggie
goes down. Yeah, Reggie up.
Like before she said a word, it was the farthest down point on the graph except for the sensor.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't think up and down can really convey befuddlement.
Yeah,
which was probably what was being felt at the time of the sensor. With
it's mm-hmm. more like Cammy's on the stage. How bad is this going to be?
Yeah,
and it wasn't that bad. It was not that bad.
But she wasn't on there very often.
Last year it was so bad everyone expected it to be.
Yeah,
bad.
It was. It wasn't as toe curling as the family anecdotes and all that sort of stuff. But I mean, in terms of the announcements, John, which was the ones that pricked your ears up the most?
Well, I mean, Metroid, of course. I was really, really happy.
Yeah, the thing is, I had the shock totally ruined for me because I was traveling home at the time. So by the time I got home, to watch the conference, the headlines were everywhere. But for someone who was, not there, but just watching it from remote, was that just like totally shocking? I kind of
It was completely bizarre because at first I didn't realize, so there's a new Metroid game, assuming that it's just being made by Nintendo themselves. And I was like, it's being made by Team Ninja. Like, where did that come from? Like, it's one of those things where I didn't believe it. I thought it was BS. Like, I thought somebody was joking, because I think I read it on the Twitter feed, and I thought somebody was just BSing. Right. I'm just like, seriously? So, I mean, I was completely out of left field.
It does remind me of when the full media summit, and it comes through Punch Out, Sin and Punishment 2. I thought that was a joke at the time. It's even more bizarre than that, to be fair.
It's funny because when the video started rolling of that, there wasn't really an indication that it was Metroid. It just kind of looked like generic sci-fi
stuff. It was the Team Ninja logo, wasn't it, at first? First thing you saw.
We're watching like, huh? Team Ninja? What? Huh?
And then it's like plus Nintendo. Then it was times Nintendo.
Yeah, and then it was just some generic sci-fi shit. And people are like laughing in there. I'm not kidding. They're literally laughing in the hall. And then they realize that's Samus, and the whole thing just goes silent with just this gasp.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is too is like with my internet, I couldn't watch any trailers. So I was still kind of just sitting there like, you got to be shitting me. Unless I see video proof of this, I'm not buying this at all. So, it's just going by. I feel like I'm sitting there going by hearsay. Like I was out in the boonies effectively. So,
that kind of leads on to, now that you've had time to kind of digest it, you've seen the trailers and all that. What's your excitement level for Metroid Other M?
It looks pretty cool. It's just like anything. I mean, it's kind of like I look at it like Metroid Prime. It's like I'm cautiously optimistic.
Kind of Metroid Prime was in the works. You weren't sure how it was going to turn out. With the new developer.
And it's the same kind of thing with Metroid Prime, where nobody really knew how good the dev team would be. Because now it's like, okay, well, are they going to be as good as they were? Back when they had back when they had him, it's kind of unproven because I don't think they put out a game yet.
That's why this is such a brilliant move, Lindy. They need leadership, and Nintendo's there to give them, solid games to work on and some leadership.
This is what really enthuses me, because, I mean, if you look at some of the interviews afterwards and stuff, the R&D one is not only involved, but what Yoshio Sakamoto, and this is where I'm really glad we did the Metroid episode, because it provides a lot of the context for this stuff, to people to kind of know the history of the development. That the way he's talking is that basically this game is his vision for a console Metroid, in the way that Metroid Prime never was. He worked on those games kind of in a sort of consultative capacity, but it wasn't really his vision for Metroid. And we kind of talked before about how Miyamoto had a lot to do with it, as much to do with anything on the Nintendo end of how that was conceived. Whereas this is his idea, and the Team Ninja part is kind of like, well, as we also talked about, R&D1 are pretty much purely handheld, have been for like decades now. And they just don't really have the wherewithal to do it. And I guess, rather than getting like someone else from inside Nintendo to do it, they've gone to Team Ninja for the ability to do all the 3D graphics and all that. So, and if it is his concept for a console Metroid, I'm just really eager to see what that is.
Yeah.
It was this weird, like, surreal moment where it had to sink in that this is what you're looking at. You're like, this doesn't really make sense. And then after a few minutes, it hit you. But the first thing I heard, and I'm not going to say what staffer said this, is, oh, God, Samus is going to have a huge rack. Like, that was the first thing they took from the fact Team Ninja was making this game. I was like, don't put that in any writing.
Well,
let's just leave
that out.
That's
the thing. I mean, it's kind of a more natural kind of reaction when you don't know, like, all this background stuff that's going to come out now. I mean, I feel pretty safe that the sanctity of the series is going to be maintained. But, I mean, like John kind of says, you don't really know how the gameplay is all going to shake
well,
out.
Well, the thing is, they're so well known for doing these balls-out action games that really kind of aren't like, they don't kind of fit into the Metroid mold. You know, like Metroid's more about kind of solitary, you know, exploring sort of thing. Never really too many enemies being thrown at you at one time, but, you know.
No, it's not too dependent on the combat or anything like that. So it will be really interesting, but I certainly am very much encouraged and intrigued just by the idea of, okay, well, you know, we've always talked about the fact that, you know, your sort of Metroid Dread kind of went away. And then there hasn't been one on the DS, and it's like, well, you know, has R&D1 kind of given up on Metroid? Like, they're just going to make Rhythm Heaven from now on or whatever? But it's like, no,
you know,
they were thinking about doing a Metroid, but it just wasn't for the handhelds. And this is what it's going to be like. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah.
I guess the main thing I would say about the conference, I guess that was a disappointing in a way. It was not so much about the conference, just E3 in general, was that some of these titles that we were hoping for in 2009, like Sin and Punishment 2 or Endless Ocean 2 or maybe Cosmic Walker, if we'd heard something about that, are not going to show up this year.
Yeah.
So it's just looking a bit thinner than I was expecting personally. Because, I mean, the stuff for 2010 is just looking great. I mean, Sin and Punishment 2, Galaxy 2, I mean, that's two sequels to, like, two of my favourite games of all time. It would be extremely dishonest for me to say anything other than I'm very excited about that. But for this year, New Super Mario Brothers looks great, but other than that, I mean, there's not that much from Nintendo.
Well, it's better than last year, and...
Yeah.
Well, I'm more excited about Mario than I was for anything at the end of last year, as you might imagine. I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, a new side-scroll. I mean, I know the multiplayer obviously is a huge element, but the fact is it's, you know, I mean, a new side-scrolling Mario on a console, I mean, that's wonderful. I mean, it really is.
Well, I mean, the one thing I will say, just referring to the holidays, it's just kind of like an interesting sort of trend I'm seeing, is that the holidays, the Christmas time isn't as big as it used to be. Like, I was thinking of, like, you know, like God of War 3, everybody was like, what the hell, that's been moved out to March of next year.
And normally, you know what, like, that is, though. I mean, that's probably like a case of, that is literally as soon as they can get it, and they
probably
need it in that financial year.
Yep.
Like, that's where, because if they don't get it in March, then, you know, next year's financials will probably look as bad as this year's did.
True.
Yes.
Yep.
maybe even worse.
Very good point.
Or maybe developmentally, it might actually would like to come out later. But,
yeah.
You know, they've got to get it.
I think a big reason the Christmas season's less important is because it's stupid to put all your games out at one time. Because
it's stupid to put all of them out, yeah. And I mean
you're just cannibalizing your own sales.
Nintendo's been doing this for a while. I mean, it's more apparent now, but I mean, like, they released Wind Waker in what, like, February? I mean,
it made the winter in Japan, and then I think it was maybe like March in America, as I recall.
Well, Sunshine came out in the summer too.
That was in the summer. Yeah, but that had to come out in the summer, didn't it? It's Mario Sunshine.
Well, it didn't have to. I mean,
well, it didn't in Europe, so I guess it didn't have to.
No, it didn't.
All right. Well, we'll get past the E3 stuff there. Get into the new business proper. We're going to start with John. So what have you been playing over these past several weeks now?
Well, the game I took with me on the honeymoon was Grand Theft Auto Chinatown Wars, which we've
nice
already
choice.
Touched on. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
yeah, it's about as unromantic as you can get.
And about as exclusionary as you can get.
But yeah, I mean, it's that game is, it's consistently amazed me with how good that game is. Just, I mean, it's, you know, it's funny because I don't think of myself as really a big fan of the Grand Theft Auto franchise particularly, but I just seem to get, I mean, I haven't, like, so some of the ones on the PS2 I didn't play through, but just recently I just seem to get every single Grand Theft Auto game and just play them all the way through, and I'll do it with Chinatown Wars.
Or not play them all the way through in the case of the downloadable ones.
True. That's true.
Well, have you completed the game?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because
it's big too.
There's
there's
not a lot of it, but the game interacts with their website.
Yeah.
Which is really cool, and it does unlock a little bit of extra content, even though it's almost nothing in terms of content-wise. It's just still, I don't know, I thought it was just really awesome, even though it's only, like, two missions.
Yeah, it kind of made me have sort of, like, a new respect for Rockstar in a way, because I think they kind of get pigeonholed, like, oh, well, all they can do is just make Grand Theft Auto games for, you know, 360 or whatever, but I was like, you know what? I mean, they actually, like, the amount that they use the touchscreen and stuff in that, and in ways that actually make sense. That are actually fun. I mean, all that kind of stuff. I was like, you know, there's some really good game design here. I mean, people kind of write them off as, yeah, they just follow that Grand Theft Auto formula.
Well, I'm sure there was probably a little bit of suspicion when it was being put on the DS that they might phone it in a bit, you know, and just rely on the strength of the brand. But it definitely doesn't sound like they've done that at all.
No.
I mean, it could very well dark horse things like Game of the Year awards for the DS. I mean,
yeah.
It is that
good.
I don't
see why not. I mean, you see the reception. It's, I mean, it is the most well-received, you know, on the aggregator sites of any DS game that's ever been, which is quite an accolade. I mean, considering
when that game was announced, there was no way anybody thought that was going to happen.
Yeah,
I mean, we were like, oh, good, we got a logo from Nintendo.
Well, I think that's some of the reason why the reception is as good as it is because it's kind of outperformed people's expectations, and that kind of response that elicits tends to lead to bigger scores, I think.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
So what else have you been playing, John?
I've finally got to spend a little bit of time with Punch-Out. I played it briefly for, you know, maybe an hour or two.
I'm in the same boat.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
So that makes three of us. Great.
Oh, you too, James. Yeah. you've got Punch-Out.
Yeah, I cracked it out for the sake of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fair enough. So you're three relative Punch-Out. I suppose I should say I have finished title defense. I've pretty much beaten the game, as it were.
No, is that the first time through?
The title defense is the second time.
Okay.
It gets quite a lot harder, but I'd like to hear first of all, John, what you sort of just your initial impressions of it.
It's really good. I mean, it's everything as advertised. I mean, I think it kind of feels sort of stripped down. I mean, I just, for some reason, I just feel like they maybe could have fleshed it out with some different modes or something.
The one thing I would say is once you get to the later bits and the fights get more complicated, you know, you feel like you've been given, you know, quite a lot of, you know, it feels like a lot of stuff to do just because, you know, these fights require kind of a lot of learning and, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of practice to sort of execute them. So it doesn't, you don't feel short. I didn't feel shortchanged at the end of it.
No, I mean, I don't feel shortchanged at all, but I kind of feel like it's the sort of game where once I do a finite number of tasks, I won't really have much reason to go back to it.
Well, have you tried balance board mode yet? Because I think that's going to make all the difference in the world.
Oh, yeah, not a lot of positive things to be heard about the way the balance board is implemented. I think probably token would be one of the more charitable things associated with it. But you've got the exhibition challenges. So they're like these achievement style things, which are kind of interesting, and they kind of show you what is possible. Like, you know, with like how quickly you could defeat fighters if you actually really figure it out and stuff. So that's kind of cool. But yeah, I mean, this is not a game that's going to have loads of different modes or you're going to play for, you know, tens and tens of hours on end. I mean, that's just not what it is. It's still Punch-Out.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I just think that the core game mechanic is so good. It's just like, I mean, it is a very worthy follow-up to the Super Nintendo version and the original Nintendo version. I mean,
yeah, although obviously it's much closer to the originals. I mean, I've played Super Punch-Out recently, so, and you have, so perhaps you could illuminate on me on more than this, but Super Punch-Out was a little more kind of like, it added more things, like, and you had that little super thing at the bottom and stuff, you know, like, it go more back to basics with this one, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing I really haven't figured out or mastered is really how to properly use the star punches. So
it's not easy.
Well, as it goes on, I mean, the ways that you get them are kind of a bit more sort of intricate. Like, there's always the occasional thing where they'll do like a little pose and they kind of goad you into punching them, and if you do them right, you will get a star.
Yeah, like with Great Tiger, where he moves his head and you hit him right away and he gives you the star.
Yeah, there's still that, but you can get them in like other interesting sort of ways, and if you can find ways to build them up quickly and then hit someone with the three-star punch, that can actually get you like instant knockouts.
Yeah, I noticed once I got into the world circuit, they seemed to be coming a lot more frequently than they were earlier in the game.
Yeah, well, I think what happens is as they get more durable, the opponents, like if you want to get a TKO, you know, knock them down three times in one round, you may well need that, you know, the extra firepower to actually, you know, be able to do that.
Yeah.
So, especially in title defense, because, you know, you get some really quite epic sort of fights. So TYP, did you have any comments to make on Punch-Out before we move on?
Well, I was surprised at how taken aback I was by the racism card.
It's pretty bad.
Oh, they don't hold back at all.
I really didn't think it was going to happen, but and I punted in, and I'm like, you know what? I don't want to play those other people in the house, and I turned it back off.
Okay. I mean, it's kind of walks a lot. You know, it's this sort of, it's more national than racial, obviously.
Bear Hugger?
Yeah.
Bear Hugger. I'm from Canada, and I don't know anybody like Bear Hugger.
Really?
Well, aren't the developers Canadian?
Yeah, they are. Oh, no, I mean, there's nothing malign about it.
It's very clear when you play it that it's all in good fun.
Yeah. It's playful, but, you know, I mean, it's...
I will say, when you are up there, if you punch somebody, salmons actually do float around their face. Yeah. I can confirm
John's been in enough barroom brawls to know that, okay? So, yeah, but it is good that I think they didn't... I've said this before, I think it's good they didn't sanitize it, because it would have been a... You know, I think you would have felt its absence more if they did.
Nintendo was bold to let the developers do that. I mean, think about it. You know, this is the most mainstream system they've had in a long time. They could get a lot of flack for this.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is not one of the games that they chose to sort of bury like ExciteBots. You know, I mean, they had a good, robust campaign for it in America. Really great commercials with Paul Malignaggi. The guy from The Wire as Doc Lewis, which is just brilliant. Oh, that's so good. Yeah, if you don't know who he is, he's also in 25th Hour, that's by Spike Lee, and he just goes pretty much everything I've ever seen him in, so obviously he's a great choice for Doc Lewis. But he had great promotion, and like, we just saw the MPDs like tonight, and it's in the top 10, sold about 140,000 copies or whatever, so, you know, I mean, this game is out there, so I suppose TYP's right to point, you know, there could be blowback,
there could be some backlash here. I want to say though that Doc Lewis's voice acting is probably some of the most unintentionally hilarious voice acting I've seen in the past five or six years.
Is it unintentional? It feels like he's reading, but maybe they're trying to go for the whole, like, he's kind of punch drunk because he's gone a bit silly in the head.
It's like, hey, Mac, what's your favorite protein shake? Mine's chocolate. Like, there's no pause there.
Join the Nintendo Fun Club. Nintendo.
Yeah, there's some good jokes in there. There's another one, like, there's a real obscure trivia in there, like, where you're fighting Bull, and he says, if you can't beat him at boxing, maybe you should try arm wrestling him, which is a reference to the fact that Bull made a cameo in something as an arm wrestler.
Like,
what kind of super trivia is that? That's pretty amazing. All right, well, we'll move on from Punch-Out. John, you had something about DSiWare you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, I got Pictobits for DSiWare. That's really good.
Yeah, so this is Art Style, another of the Art Style games, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really good. It's entirely, the whole theme is like retro NES games. And the way it works is, you know, it's a puzzler, of course, but you generally, the best way to describe it is you kind of like the... It's like Tetris with, you know, the floating Tetramino type shapes floating down the screen. And you basically, you have a bar with 10 squares worth of blocks that you have, and you can paint those blocks on the screen. And so you're pretty much, it's like the Tetraminos falling down the screen are like keys, and you essentially create the lock for them to go into. And then when you do that... Right. It clears them all. It's really, really good. Each stage has, you know, you can earn coins from clearing out shapes, and then you can use those coins to open up the dark stages for each stage, which is like kind of like a reverse harder stage. And you know, everything has a theme. Like, there's like one for like Excitebike.
So what's happening is, as you're clearing these like little blocks, they become pixels in a sort of pixel art thing, right?
Correct. So up on the top screen.
As you clear them, it forms a sprite in the above thing. So like an Excitebike guy or something from Mario or whatever. And then there's 8-bit music that's been like remixed or whatever to accompany all this, as I understand.
Yep. And, you know, and once you fill out the little pixel picture, that's when you move on to the next level. So
the music is like old Nintendo chiptunes?
Oh yeah.
It's not just that.
It is like, it's been remixed by somebody or something, and it kind of like blends together.
So it's like the Tetris game for DS.
Yep. Yeah. It's really good. I was actually really impressed by it.
Well, I guess DSiWare is kind of gaining a little bit of momentum now. Like, some good things heard about the Flip Champs game by Way Forward, and then you've got Mario vs. Donkey Kong, which came out at the beginning of this week, which, you know, is not just bits stripped out of the old one. There are new levels to it, apparently. And
you can, obviously, there's
the level creation feature may not be as new as it was... touted as at the conference, but
that,
you know,
that's
still cool. It does sound like the way you would download levels from that is better. So, you know, we're getting there.
Until they turn the service off in 9 months,
well,
as John said.
Yeah. It could be. We've got a whole year, probably. Enjoy
you got at least
left.
A year, you know that, so enjoy it.
But, you know, I mean... I guess the only thing is, you know, if they'd had a virtual console, handheld virtual console announcement at E3, I think I'd be quite a lot closer to buying one.
I probably would have bought one from that Best Buy vending machine in the LAX airport if they had announced that.
All right, so is that about it, John?
That's it, man.
All right, TYP, let's move on to you.
Well, all right, so aside from the whole E3 thing, I kind of... decided to do things a little differently and play old games instead of new games.
I endorse this route.
Well, I mean, I played some Punch-Out, but before I left Japan, about, I don't know, a week before I left Japan, I went shopping for some games. I picked up Captain Rainbow.
Yes.
For Nick.
Sweet.
Oh, yes.
So we played it as a kind of a community.
Yeah.
A little bit during E3. And it's a weird game.
It really is.
Really?
You hadn't heard, huh?
I guess Aaron had watched some videos or something, so he had some sort of notion of what to do. So he wound up playing for a bit, and it's just weird.
Yeah.
I
assume you could, like, you know, understand what was going on with the text and everything, so.
Oh, no, sure, yeah. Really? No, I spent about 20 minutes running around the beach, slamming into things and getting hurt because I didn't know what the hell I was supposed to do.
I actually walked into the room after they'd already started playing, and I asked somebody what's going on, and the response I got was simply, like, a worried I don't know. Like, it wasn't just straight I don't know. There was legitimate concern in their
voice.
Well,
I guess, I mean, this is a pretty unique way to experience Captain Rainbow. It does sound like, you know, pretty perfect, actually, just sort of the shared experience of absolute bemusement.
Did
you get a sense of, like, how, like, whether it was, you know, like, legitimately good or was it all
No, I mean, obviously, if you could read the text, it would probably help you figure out what you're supposed to do, but it seems like the interface is kind of clunky, you're kind of running around slowly, and when you turn into Captain Rainbow, the concept is just this, like, nerd or something that has thick glasses, but then you magically turn into Captain Rainbow after you find a special suit or something. But even as Captain Rainbow, you're just running around, and you don't seem that powerful. Maybe you're better able to communicate with people or something. Maybe that's the idea. I don't know. But
it seems like it's really leveraged on its humor as well, doesn't it? Because you've got all these bizarre cameos of, like, you know, old Nintendo characters and, like, a little Mac that's let himself go, and, you know,
which is more hilarious now because Punch-Out.
It really is.
Yeah, advanced war soldiers and, you know, all sorts of, you know, like, and so if you don't have a high level understanding of Japanese, you'd be missing out on, you know, on that to a large extent. So I don't think there's much hope of it ever coming anywhere else.
No, there's not.
Well, I think it sold abysmally in Japan.
It did.
And that's to be expected because you're saying it has to be like intersection of people that are hardcore Nintendo fans that like know about these franchises and they're able to get the humor and
enjoy
this type of game.
Yes, but it's very weird, like, how that game even came into being.
Of course.
Because, just looking at it, there's, like, I don't see, A, how this game was thought of, and B, how someone at Nintendo said, make it.
Yeah, how it got the green light.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are other more worthy games that...
On that subject, you know, but they did make a Tingle game, and there's been a suggestion that there might be another one.
Yes,
recently. So, hope springs eternal for all sorts of these.
I want that Tingle game in the U.S. immediately.
You can import it from Europe.
Yeah.
Anyway, while I was shopping for Captain Rainbow at the store, Book Off, they were having a really good deal on all of their Game Boy games, at least the original and Game Boy Color. And it was pretty much 400 yen across the board. for anything. Wow. Any Game Boy or Game Boy Color game they had, and other stores I'd been to, you know, they're more meticulous about pricing it and everything. So I picked up a few games. I picked up Kirby's Tilt and Tumble, which is, I think it's Coco Kirby in Japanese. And I picked up Super Mario Land 2, which I never owned. I just, because it was during that period of time when I'd lost my Game Boy. I didn't have one, but right. I would play it on like car rides when other people had their Game Boy. So I picked that up, as well as, I guess it was Mole Mania? As far as I can tell, it's Mole Mania.
It sounds familiar, but I couldn't tell you anything.
Which I have not played yet. So I, you know, I was sort of taking it easy this week. I'm sort of recovering from E3 and everything. And yeah. So I'm playing a little bit of, I said, well, I want to play some Kirby Tilt and Tumble. You know, I heard good things about it. So I put it in my Game Boy Advance SP, which, you know, since it's a Game Boy Color, I can't use my DS.
Yeah.
And I start playing and I'm like, oh crap, it's upside down. Like, because the cart is sticking out of the bottom, the tilt sensor is kind of reversed. You know, like tilting forward, tilts backwards. So I did something I thought I would never have to do again in my life, which is bust out my original Game Boy Advance. There is a reason I kept it, see?
Nice.
And so I played that. It's a really good game, except it's impossible to see the damn thing on the
And you're tilting
the screen, so there's no way to have a good, you know, constant light source.
Yeah.
But the actual game is a lot of fun. I've only played a few levels, but the level design is interesting. It's actually quite difficult. It's very easy to kill yourself falling off an edge.
A Kirby game? A challenge?
Oh, yeah. This one's pretty challenging. I mean, it's a lot of fun. I wish I had a means of playing it on a system that I could see.
Yeah, I can't really think of a solution for that.
Super Game Boy on your SNES.
Well, I was thinking my Game Boy Player, but... That would work either, because that's upside down. But I could hold the GameCube backwards.
Just stand there holding the GameCube,
tilt the
turning
whole cube. There's a screw on it. I could do it.
So what about? I'm interested in what you think about Super Mario Land 2, because I had a similar experience to you actually, but I played it on a couple of occasions when it was like toy day at school at the last day of the year, and played like most of the game on a friend's Game Boy, and I seem to remember really enjoying it. But it must have quite a different perspective now, having played all the Wario games that they went on to make.
Yeah, exactly. I remembered it being more like a Mario game than it actually is. I mean, it definitely is closer to being a Mario game than the original Mario Land, which is a great game, but it doesn't feel like a Mario game. And Mario Land 2 has more of the trappings. It has more of the baddies you expect to see in a Mario game. They look more like their Super Mario World counterparts.
Yeah, sure.
But it definitely is kind of somewhere between Wario Land and Mario Land, which is what you would expect, I suppose.
Yeah.
The power-up system feels a lot like Wario Land 1. Like when you hit the box, except for maybe the mushroom, which actually moves, you know, they stick there, they stay there, and if you go off screen, you can come back and pick up the power-up later. And when you get powered up, you like Mario. You know, when I was talking about New Super Mario Brothers Wii at E3 with people, we were talking about how when you pick up a power-up, the entire game kind of stops.
Yeah, and it does the little animation.
Well, it doesn't do that in Wario Land games, and it doesn't do that in this game. So, I mean, there are these little touches. I'm like, yeah, this really is from a different development team. But the level design's really interesting. The worlds are very interesting. I mean, even compared to, like, New Super Mario Brothers, the environments you're in are definitely creative. As you would expect from the team that makes Wario Land games.
Yeah.
The team that went on to make Wario Land games. But the game is very short. I was surprised. You know, I'd played bits and pieces. I was not as good a gamer when I played it before. It's a very short game. I got to the final level, I'd say, in an hour and a half of
play. Yeah, it would have to be short for me to finish it in toy day. So
it was pretty short. I know there are a couple of levels that have alternate exits that I don't think I stumbled upon.
So a bit like
Mario
World, like you've got these, because it is a lot. I mean, the trapping, the external trappings, like the world maps and stuff, is very sort of, it was after Mario World, and you know,
they're trying to emulate it, definitely. But as the folks over at Retronauts have touched on, it's kind of like, it's almost like the development team kind of didn't like the fact that they were making a Mario game, because there's all sorts of bizarre things. Like, they got away with whatever they could. Like, there's certain things that would never be in a normal Mario game. You might see in Super Paper Mario or something like that. But, like, yeah. There's still, like, an area that feels more like a Gradius level or whatever in the space world. In the space world.
He actually goes into space this time.
Yes, he does.
He goes into space, and there's just this area where it's kind of like you're maneuvering around all these obstacles, not, you know, trying not to get hurt. It feels a lot like the submarine level, or actually no, the airplane level in the original Mario Land.
In the original one, yeah, that's right.
There are just some other things, like there's like a giant Mario. This is Mario. You're in Mario Land.
Oh, the big Mario robot.
You know, yeah, like the robot clockwork.
Mario sort of fiefdom or whatever.
Yeah, it's like the development team really did. It's like, geez, Mario's so full of himself. We got to make a Mario game. Geez, you know, Mario. So like they put Mario everywhere. You know. So it's kind of like you sympathize with Wario. Now, I didn't beat the game. The final level is actually really hard, and I did remember that.
Yeah, I've never
compared to the rest of the game. The last level is very hard, and Wario is kind of sneaky. It's hard to jump on him. He's kind of fast. So I did not actually complete the game. I got to the very end, but I haven't completed it yet. But it's a lot of fun. I guess 400 yen is about the right price for it, though. I mean, it's pretty short.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of fun.
I mean, I guess what if we were to have a handheld virtual console, you'd kind of, 400 yen, you know, is 400 Nintendo points.
Yeah, $4. Yeah, $4.
I would hope that we would have, like, original Game Boy games for that or less, maybe. But
yeah.
It might be 500, but I still think it would be well worth it to play like these. Because I did get to play some like that on Friends and so, but I missed out on a lot of that era.
I
would be desperate to play a lot of these old games. So, I've picked up some, like Metroid 2 and stuff, but you just can't find everything, especially if you're not in Japan, where they're just selling them off, like,
I mean,
whatever.
I never owned the original Game Boy, so I'm sure there's tons of games that I'd be interested in playing.
No,
so.
I'm still surprised they haven't done it yet, and I really look forward to when they do. All right, well, we'll move on to James. Have you got anything other than your ongoing exhaustedness?
No, I do. So when I was flying out there, I mentioned before that I had bought Rhythm Heaven with the intent of playing it, and then I bought the third Phoenix Wright game as sort of like the one I'm really pissed at Rhythm Heaven. To just,
you change your pace.
You can't get more of a change of pace than that. But
I guess so. Yeah.
But it's funny because once that game hit my DS somewhere over the Great Lakes, so that's when Rhythm Heaven came out, and it has yet to leave it since.
It's an awesome game.
It is. It is fantastic.
It really pulls you in.
The first game really, really got me, and I actually bought the second game the day it came out, and I was a little bit disappointed, although the second game's final case is fantastic.
The second game is definitely my least favorite in the entire series, including 4.
And have you played, what is it, 4 of the 4 of them? Have you, TYP? Is that how many?
I've played all of them, and I don't know if I reviewed all of them. I think I did. I may have not. You know what? No, I didn't review 4, I think. I think I let someone else crack that one open. But
there's been 4 to date on the DS, and then there's the Perfect Prosecutor coming.
Yes, and I am so excited for that game now. You know, it's funny because...
And you've played 4, haven't you, James?
I have 4, and then I just kept going, I'm not going to play it. I'm going to get 3.
Oh, right, had it.
Yeah, I'd recommend playing 1, then 3, then 4. 2, if you really liked 1, play 2 first. Play them in order.
Yeah.
But 2, you can skip.
Cues to 2 and 3 that were nice to remember. But for whatever reason...
Well, that's why I played in order. That way you don't get...
Yeah, I got so turned off on 2 and never went... Because 2 and 3 came out pretty close together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I never went around to getting it, and I got it, and now I've probably poured like I'm going out at lunch just so I have an excuse to be away from people and play the game. It's that bad.
3 is pretty epic, especially the final case. It really builds up.
It does.
And you do an excellent job of kind of tying a bow in the entire trilogy. It's really well done. I think the localization is maybe better in the first one, but the actual storytelling and plot, I think, is best.
The first one has a lot of cultural jokes, and they sort of backed off on it in 2 and 3, I guess because they realized those jokes will become essentially lose any value as they are no longer culturally relevant.
I thought it was because they had a different translator.
Oh, that's possible, too. But, I mean, they're still funny. They're just not...
Yeah, well, 3 is very good. 2, yeah.
Yeah,
it's good. It's only bad in comparison to these other games.
Yeah, three is absolutely just blowing my mind. It just in the amount of, like, I'm basically going to start playing four as soon as I finish three.
You're
going
to go straight onto that. Maybe that'll take you through to when the new one comes out.
Oh, it's good though, because this was a good, like, bring down from what I went through the last week, because I don't really consider this gaming. It's more like reading one of those interactive novels.
It's an interactive novel as much as anything. Yeah,
it's a if you haven't played these games, if you can find them, definitely go get them, because they are fantastic.
Yeah, they're really good.
No, that's great. And anything else before we move on?
Nothing really major, no.
Fair enough. All right, well, I'll close this out with new business. I play a lot of Punch-Out. You know, doing title defense requires discipline and
nerves of steel.
Hours of
stiff upper lip.
It is tough. It is one of the most satisfyingly tough things I've done in games for quite a while. I mean,
he's like a lion.
The thing is, I just find that game controls, the controls, like the punching is so satisfying.
It is very satisfying, you know, because when you, some of these guys at the end, they will beat you so many times when you finally beat them.
Oh, it's a Greg game for sure.
Yeah.
It's a cathartic experience.
I actually had my first experience of that with Bald Bull right before we recorded.
Yeah, I mean, Bald Bull title defense is like epic, and like there was one time when I came basically one punch short of a TKO.
Oh.
Like, you know, and I was like, ah! I just couldn't,
like, as the
it.
Bell rang, were you like rearing back to hit him?
Yeah, like, yeah, if the punch had connected, he would have been down, and then it's, you know, they would have been over. But you know, when you then beat him after that, it feels great. So that's been wonderful. But totally different kind of game I've been playing is Klonoa for Wii. So this is a slightly more relaxed,
a little bit
game. Very
more
sort of
voices.
It's very easy, very kind of docile, really, platformer. But I like it. I like. I think it, you know, it does manage to be interesting while being very easy. You know, with some of the way it handles the designs, and I think there's one thing in particular that I think the 3D Marios could take a cue from, because I know long ago when we did an episode with Johnny, he was talking about Galaxy when it had not long come out, and he was saying, you know, one of the problems that 3D Marios have is, you know, how to make the enemies like important, because, you know, it's so easy in three dimensions to just kind of bypass them. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't really have to jump on them. You can just kind of walk around them, unless they were like really aggressive. But the thing about Klonoa is that it plays on a 2D plane, you know, essentially, even though the graphics are 3D and everything. But what it makes you do is, if you need to double jump, you need to have an enemy to do that. It kind of pushes off the enemy and goes into the air. And what that does is it makes you engage the enemies. You know, you have to do it to be able to get to certain places.
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. I mean, I think they kind of did that a little bit in Doki Doki Panic / Super Mario Brothers 2 USA. And in Yoshi's Island for the Super Nintendo, because you need to eat enemies
to get eggs. Mm-hmm. So, well, that's the thing. I mean, because Yoshi is going to be in Galaxy 2, you know, I mean, they could do similar things. And, you know, I was thinking about that as well. You know, the way you had the way you used the star bits and stuff. I mean, you know, if Yoshi's got eggs, you could use the pointer to fire them. You know, I mean, there's lots of applications that you could do with Yoshi that would make him a lot more sort of interesting than his relatively token implementation in Super Mario Sunshine.
Definitely.
But the point is just that, you know, like you said, Doki Doki Panic, Yoshi, I mean, these are 2D games that have like sort of made you engage with the enemies because they're useful. But what's interesting is I haven't seen that done in 3D, where it's probably more valuable. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you're stuck on a 2D plane, well, you're kind of forced to engage with them anyway to an extent, because, you know, there's only so much room. So I think that could be a really cool application. But go back to Klonoa itself. The way it kind of, this whole sort of 2.5D so-called that it does is, it's kind of a more meaningfully 2.5D. It's not just 2D, but with polygonal graphics. You do actually sort of like throw stuff into the screen, as it were, or towards the screen, you know, like you're using the sort of the depth element, and the paths wind and intertwine. It's just visually interesting to see things in the distance and wonder, you know, how does that interconnect? And then, you know, as you go through the level, you get to explore that. So it might be easy, but it's very pleasant and very enjoyable. The controls with, I've been using classic controller, very tight, even though you've got this got fluid, expressive animation, but there isn't. Sometimes with games like that, you know, there's a bit of a too much of a delay, if you know what I mean, because it kind of over animates. You don't really have that in this. It all feels pretty much right. The presentation's a little bit twee for me, you know?
Yeah, the storytelling, I mean, I've played through maybe two-thirds of the Japanese version.
Yeah, you wrote impressions for us from the Japanese version.
Yeah, and the storytelling really got on my nerves, and I realized, oh, I can push plus to fast forward, which, dear Lord, thank God. But
the English voice acting is very Saturday morning cartoon, as you would expect. You know, I wouldn't say it was especially bad, but obviously it's not really meant for me by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, the way that the structure of the game, like, I understood very, very little of the plot, really, but the structure, you can tell it's like a Saturday morning cartoon where it's like every level or every two levels, you have a new friend that you have to help out is kind of, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a surprisingly dark turn at one point, actually, but yeah, in general, it is.
Yes, it does.
That's around where I stopped playing.
It was surprising, but you know, it is it is very Saturday morning cartoony. I mean, that's just what it is. And TYP says you can skip it if you don't want to deal with that. You could skip it and just enjoy the games. And it does have a very Yoshi's Island style thing in that you have these like medallion pieces or something that are pretty much like the big flowers in Yoshi's Island. So they'll be located in that's where like what challenge is in the game is sort of found, is that they'll be in these sort of tricky locations where you might have to do like a consecutive double jumps where you do a double jump, snag an enemy out of the air, then use that to do another one to then get, you know, this where the sort of play mechanics actually get more kind of rigorously exploited and stuff. So those are kind of fun to collect, and I think you do get some kind of extra content for getting them all. Hopefully I'm not being strung along on that. But it is fun
useless
to get them
exercises
in. It is fun to get them in themselves, to be fair.
How great would that be if at the end they're like, good job, you collected them all, you get nothing.
Well, you know, you don't get much for getting a lot of the treasures in Wario Land, but I didn't care. They're great. I mean, it's like, just fun to get.
You now get to play through the entire game again. Here's a bracelet.
No, you now get to play through the entire game again, period.
There is a mirror mode where you play through the whole game again in reverse.
Nice.
Yeah.
Obviously inspired by Super Ghouls and Ghosts. Very nice.
No.
See, just look for these things. Look for the patterns, and you'll see it everywhere.
I was under the impression there's like a new extra room in each level.
Yeah,
I think there is.
I think there is extra stuff that you can get that's more important than a bloody mirror mode. But that is in there. So, I mean, it's the thing
Ghouls
is
and Ghosts,
the
bloody.
The main thing I would say is that, you know, it's priced right.
Yeah.
Because it isn't the most substantial game, but you can get it over here now commonly. Well, you can get it over here at release for about the equivalent of about $23. And in America, it's, you know, it came out at $30, and you can probably get it cheaper than that maybe if you shop around. So yeah, for the sort of substance of the game, it's about right. So I mean, it's worth investigating if you like traditional platformers, especially as, you know, other than the Virtual Console, you probably haven't been playing that many of them lately. I mean, even on DS, there's not a huge amount.
No, it's kind of surprising in a way.
Right, well, that's going to bring new business to a close, and we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to catch up with your listener mail with some interesting things that came out of E3, and then after that, we've got the close to our retroactive number 6, Zelda 2. And straight into the listener mail. And John, you have the first letter.
All right. Adolf Vega in Denton, Texas writes, now that Mario vs. Donkey Kong Minnie's March Again has been released and WarioWare Do-It-Yourself is coming, do you think that Nintendo should make a level editor in New Super Mario Bros. Wii or have a WiiWare download where you can trade and make your own 2D Mario levels? People online have been making levels using Mario ROMs for years. Not that we ever would endorse such a thing. So this would be tons of fun.
I'm sure it would be.
Yeah, it would be.
I've played some of those levels online, though, and it's just ridiculous amounts of masochism.
Well, yeah, I mean, one reason why Nintendo is probably reluctant to do this is because they want to have tight control over the levels with Mario in them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they realize that it's really brutal stuff. People aren't going to have fun, and it may kind of tarnish the Mario platformer brand. Also, they like to make money. I mean, so if you can make any level you want, then you don't need to buy expansion packs like Super Mario Advance Wars, Super Mario Brothers 3 with the Dot Matrix cards or whatever they were.
Yeah, the e-reader. Yeah,
the e-reader was genius in just the amount of pure cash grabbing it was. Hey, you want extra levels? You don't get to know what levels are in this pack, but there are extra levels in here.
I think with Nintendo, they tend to look at it like, okay, we want this to be for a broad audience, and honestly, how broad an audience is going to sit there and make these new Mario levels, right?
Well, how broad an audience is going to download them?
The stats that people talk about, whether it's the Guitar Hero, you know, song creation, or it's Little Big Planet or whatever, is that, you know, we are expecting a very small percentage of people to make levels, but as long as, you know, enough people buy the game, that small percentage will yield enough very dedicated people to, you know, sort of feed something of a sort of vibrant scene. But
yeah,
I agree with TYP. They're probably just, you know, not too happy about people sort of being liberal with Mario. And then on the other hand, I mean, as you said, you know, it's not so much necessarily just the small number of people that would create levels for this, but they probably perceive as a real mass market product. We're talking about essentially the sequel to the DS game that sold in excess of 15 million copies.
Yes.
It might be closer to 20 million at this point worldwide. That, you know, how many of those people are actually going to be people that would want to download levels?
That's true.
You know, so I guess they just think it's not worth their while to put that kind of implementation in the game.
I mean, we're dealing with Nintendo, who is as paranoid a company as one can be.
Yeah.
Just imagine what our Funhouse goers would do with Level Creator.
Yeah.
Imagine what terrible things you would see built out of blocks.
That's the point, I think, one of the issues why it wouldn't happen, is because Nintendo, hypothetically, you know, could be, like, really careful with the way the tools are and things about how you know, what you can do in levels, but, you know, that care means time and effort.
Yes.
And that's time and effort they're unwilling to expend.
Yeah.
Right, and as seen by the recent Smash Brothers Brawl announcement, I guess they haven't found that it was worth their while there to keep it up.
I just don't think they want the overhead to do it.
I mean, maybe, yeah. I mean, that's probably just past a point where there's just so little activity that it's just like, right, that's it. You know, not worth their while time. Shut up shop. And I mean, we see this, I mean, because, you know, what the guys talked about at E3, you know, it's just like, I mean, far more, I mean, level creation would be great and all that, and downloading new levels and stuff, but far more fundamental thing, online play, is apparently not worth their while to put into this game.
Yeah, it's interesting, because Nintendo just seems, as a company, they seem to really like, sort of, when they design something, they're like, this is what you're going to get. It's all self-contained. You don't really have to add anything to it.
Yeah, simple, straight up. Here it is.
Well, that's a very Japanese way of looking at things. They want everything in a nice little box. Everything looks perfect. Everything, you know, very much perfectionism, triple wrapped, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it isn't this guns out blazing. Well, I don't care if there are bugs. We're going to have, you know, custom levels. And
it's
a very Japanese way of looking at game design and game packages. I mean, now, I still think that they could do online without, you know, but custom levels intrudes a little more, encroaches a little more on having, like, well-designed levels. I mean, there's a difference.
They seem to have a view of, like, it's ideally a local experience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, you know, and you can't argue with that. It is ideally a local experience. But at the same time, you know, the online part would be really valuable to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it? Because, yeah, as Johnny's mentioned, all that, you know, it's going to be a lot easier to actually play the game the way it was, you know, mostly intended. But I think the way they look at it, maybe, if you look at the Smash Brothers example, is that, you know, if they put the time and effort into an online mode but there were problems, it might almost become more trouble than it's worth, because, you know, look at all the negative press that there was about Smash Brothers.
Yeah.
Don't give them the opportunity to find something negative.
I feel like Nintendo, they still kind of look at themselves as I wouldn't say a toy company, as kind of like a, I mean, an entertainment company, whereas somebody like Sony, the way they look at themselves is almost more of like kind of like a networking company. You know what I mean? Like, they look at that as kind of their core competence, whereas Nintendo is like, we're not really too much wrapped up in the tech of it. We just want people to have kind of fun with our product and have a really simple interaction with it and just be able to enjoy it without a whole bunch of overhead crap around it.
And that's true. Nintendo doesn't have the corporate know-how. I mean, it's not in their, you know, they don't have the experience. They don't know how to build a robust operating system. They don't know how to make a complete operating system that has things running in the background at all times. You know, that isn't...
Yeah. And they don't care.
That isn't their collective knowledge, you know? And that's what you see in the way the Wii's designed.
Yeah, it's not so much worth their while to sort of learn those things either.
Yeah.
You know, I suppose is the real issue. All right, we'll move on to the next letter. And TYP, you've got this one.
All right, let's see if I can read this one. I recently stumbled upon the podcast, and you guys are doing a really amazing job. Well, thank you, I guess, to everyone else.
We're sorry we left it sitting around for people to trip over, though. We apologize.
You have a deep knowledge and a love of all things Nintendo, and it really comes across in the podcast. Keep up the great work. Okay, I have a couple of questions. First of all, I download a lot of Virtual Console titles to my Wii. When Wii 2 comes out, do you think there will be a way to transfer these downloaded titles over to it? Or will I basically have to start from scratch again and pay for the games I already have?
Yeah, interesting question. I mean, here the classic line is, well, Nintendo will make you rebuy everything.
But they do. I mean, it's not they like
do.
They haven't earned
they
that.
They do.
It is a classic line for a reason.
If they can get away with it, they will.
Yes.
The question is, do they feel like they can get away with it?
I don't think in this case that they can.
Well, I think they could,
though.
I think they could say, well, you should still own your Wii.
Well, but what if it breaks and you don't have another Wii?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, yeah, because it comes a point where, obviously, at the minute, there is some sort of convoluted process for being able to access those games on a different system if your other one has broken. But, you know, if you get to a point where the Wii isn't being serviced in the same way because they've moved on to the next one, well, then, you know, you would have preferred to have been able to transfer it over to your new next-generation console in the first place before that becomes a problem.
I could see them doing something like, okay, put all your games on Club Nintendo, and then you can download them on the new console. Because that way they benefit from it.
All they need to do is give you the license to download it again.
Yeah,
exactly. You need to do it the same way they currently say, oh, hey, you've already bought that game. You can re-download it if you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are definitely ways to do this. The real question is, will Nintendo do that or not? Some of it might
be just like the time involved. Like, you know, I think if they were to change systems like quicker, it would be more incumbent on them to do it. Whereas, you know, if you've had your Wii and those games for, like, God knows how many years already, they may feel that, you know, it just won't be such a big deal. People won't kick up so much of a fuss if they do, you know, if they do kind of screw them over on it. All right, well, we'll move on to the next part of his question.
Yeah. So, secondly, do you guys know anything about the plot for the new Metroid title? The name is really intriguing to me. In the original NES game, the ending states the following. Great, you fulfilled your mission. It will revive peace in space. I'm sorry, let me do that again. Great! You fulfilled your mission! It will revive peace in space! But it may be invaded by other Metroid.
Other Metroid.
Sorry, the other Metroid. Pray for a true peace in space. I don't remember that.
No, it's pretty famous.
I have a hard time thinking that Nintendo is going to base the title of their game on that display of the English language.
Well, it's funny. So Andrew.
Right. So the question is the newest adventure a reference to this ending on the end?
I hope to God not.
I don't think so. I think it's closer to a reference to the Game Boy game. The Game Boy game had a bunch of different types of Metroids in them, so...
The M part is somewhat cryptic, but whether it means what you think it means or maybe it got double meaning, I mean, we really don't know anything about the plot too much at this point. I think the interviews have said that it's going to take place in the gap between Super Metroid and Fusion, so this is a sort of gap that hasn't been explored before. Like, all the Prime games are set between 1 and 2.
They're gapping out now.
Yeah, this is a different gap they're looking into.
They have fully exploited the previous gap.
Well, it's still between 2 and 3, but there really isn't much time between those two, is there? But we have a definitive answer to this question because IGN made the same observation when they interviewed Yoshio Sakamoto, and they said, there was this weird line in the ending of the NES original about other Metroid. Does Other M have anything to do with that? And he had no idea what they were talking about.
So. Because in Japanese, that ending phrase probably made sense.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's a good observation. I like the way IGN picked up on it as well. I actually thought to ask Sakamoto about it, but yeah, it's got nothing to do with that. So yeah. I guess we'll never know what was meant by the other Metroid.
Oh, we'll never know if that's even what they meant by...
Well, but he's asking if we know anything about the plot for the game, and really all we know is what was in the trailer, and you can piece together that, you know, clearly there's going to be more than just Samus involved. You know, there's going to be some, this infrastructure of the Federation or whatever they called it.
What it appears to be, in addition to being set between Fusion and Super Metroid, and seems like it's going to fill in some of the backstory of Fusion, you know, the commanding officer that she had that goes on to be the computer in Fusion, because there's a reference to that in the trailer. But it also looks like it's going to chronicle, like, big parts of her life. Like, there was bits of her where she was a little girl, seemingly, and then there was the bit that was basically the finale to Super Metroid, where Mother Brain was going mental on the baby Metroid, and you know, it looks like it might, maybe just in cutscenes, but it's going to kind of cover quite a broad swath of the backstory.
Yeah.
There's certainly going to be more voice acting. I mean, they're not...
Yeah, they're using a company to just do the CG scenes that has worked with Team Ninja before. So, you know, I mean, it seems like it's going to be a fairly significant part of the game. You know, the plot seems like it's going to be a little bit more in the vein of Fusion, perhaps. Not necessarily in the structure of the game, but just in terms of having dialogue and you know, a sort of more plot-heavy approach rather than, you know, Zero Mission and Super Metroid.
I hope that doesn't mean it's going to be far more linear like Fusion was.
Yeah. Well, there's no need that it necessarily would be, but, I mean, who knows? I mean, we really have no idea. It's still, you know, for all the stuff you've seen, and there was a lot of interesting stuff in that trailer. Well worth watching it multiple times, though. I'm sure there's a bit of the speed dash in there somewhere.
There is. It seemed like it. What's intriguing to me is how are they going to mix this first and third person gameplay? It seems like they have both. They're elaborating on the side-scrolling aspect.
I mean, my first impression would be like, are the first person bits almost going to be like QTEs, essentially? Like, you know, is the base gameplay going to be like, you know, side-scrolling-ish, like third-person gameplay, but then you'll have parts where she has to shoot stuff and... Some of the bits where she's fighting Ridley and stuff almost looks like an arena battler.
They did, but...
It looks like almost like a Ninja Gaiden or something.
Really, really interesting trailer, but there is a pretty limited, you know, ultimately, what you can actually draw from it in terms of, you know, tangible evidence.
Yeah, so, I mean, really all we could draw from some of it's that they have a serious interest in telling story in a different way than the Prime games have.
Yeah, I think that's true, because, you know, Prime was mostly... especially before 3, was mostly through the scanning.
Sammy.
I'll get on to the next letter. This is from Voodoo in Chicago, and he writes, after Project Natal was shown, Microsoft claimed that the 360 will have a 10-year lifespan. What are your thoughts on this? And on a related note, do any of you actually believe the PS3 will be out for 10 years before a successor is released? And to wrap it up, what do you think Nintendo's plans are with regard to releasing a new console? So, yeah, we've heard about the PS3 10-year cycle for quite a while that they've been talking about, and now Microsoft are starting to talk about it. I mean, I think yes. I mean, I think it is probably going to go on for quite a while, because I don't sense any appetite among developers to move the technical goalposts again and raise development costs across the board on what a AAA title is.
Yeah, or even among game players, you know? I mean,
we're good.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's something of a satiation with HD that, you know, this, you know, is looks really good. You know, there's that people feel pretty satisfied.
And there are still
that.
Games coming out that are like, wow, you can do that.
Yeah.
There's more. You can always, I mean, just with more ingenious, you know, design and programming, I mean, you can always push things somewhat further. I would imagine the PS3 probably has quite a lot of potential to mine.
Yeah, also the fact that, you know, if people have a harder time coming to grips with it than they do with a 360, since the 360 is so close to a PC. So,
yes,
well, the PS3 is so close to nothing, essentially.
Exactly. I mean, it's entirely
proprietary,
like
Sony
right?
said, let's make the most confusing thing to develop for we can.
But of course, we're talking about the graphical element. But of course, what Microsoft is talking about in terms of extending its life is, okay, well, you know, it's the same platform, but we've now got a totally different sort of strand of games, because we're going to have Project Natal.
I don't know about Natal, man. It looks so lame. It looks so gimmicky. Natal. I'm sorry.
Yeah. There are two challenges here. One, Microsoft needs to make a compelling game for it, or a third party needs to make a compelling game for it that appeals to a group that frankly they're trying to get. I mean, if it only appeals to current gamers, then they're not doing, their goals aren't correct, because supposedly they're doing this to win over some of the folks that Wii has. And two, they need to make it associate very strongly with the platform. Right now, the 360 has been out there for several years. It has its own group. You know, people need to almost associate Natal as its own platform.
Yeah.
That just has the 360 as a peripheral if you really want to get to that.
Yeah. If Microsoft's smart, they'll start packing it in.
Well, they need to get, like, kind of like the Wii Fit is in some people's minds what Wii is. They need to somehow get that same mentality for Natal. And I don't know if Microsoft as a company can do that.
Well, I think it would be dependent on the software. I mean, it's got to be the software.
Yep.
And the marketing.
Yeah, and the market. Oh, the marketing's got to be there. But, you know, I mean, obviously, I mean, Natal, that would have big, I would think that would have pretty big applications in the fitness game realm, just you know, off the top of
Ubisoft
my head.
Ubisoft seems to think at least.
It could, yeah, because Ubisoft are doing their camera thing for Wii, and you know, so, I mean, you could go down that road, but, I mean, what they showed with Milo, you know, Peter Molyneux was, the, you know, this idea of the kind of interaction and all that. It's really good high concept stuff.
But it was Peter Molyneux showing it.
And that's what Molyneux does best.
Yeah,
you know,
delivering high concept stuff.
Yeah, I mean, but he could deliver it great. It could be awesome, but is it going to have traction with, you know, with the consumers on a mass level is a separate question again. So, I mean, there's a lot of questions to be answered about what it's going to do for Microsoft's lifespan, you know, the 360's lifespan. But I kind of think whether Natal succeeds or doesn't, I still think the 360 is going to be around for quite a while.
I agree. I think all three platforms, there is no real reason to move on for Wii, maybe with HD, but right now they're in the lead. You know, Nintendo's not going to be in a hurry to you know. Start,
I mean,
from
what do
scratch.
You think about, like? I mean, maybe you could see more move towards, you know. I mean, we've kind of seen it a bit already to some extent with some of these different SKUs. You know, that almost like more of a handheld approach where, you know, the platform doesn't change, but you might get a sort of premium edition, you know, where, you know, maybe a Wii that does have, you know, more memory and all this sort of stuff. But
that's far,
you know,
more likely.
It's fundamentally the same, you know, because it'd be analogous to the DSi. You know, the DSi has come along and it has successfully re-energized sales in Japan in particular.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, it's got a few new things and all that, but it's still, you know, they haven't moved on. You know, the platform is still what it is. You could do the same thing with Wii. And obviously, you know, Sony have got the new One thing and all that. I mean, there's just, I just don't think, on the fundamental level, I don't think developers want to move on.
No.
Well, you know, it's funny because I had this almost exact conversation last week with Jared Rosenberg at E3. He made a comment and he asked me, like, he said something along the lines of, well, you know, it's funny because this should be the E3 where Microsoft should have been talking about their next system. And I thought about it for a few minutes, and he was right.
If we were on the 5-year cycle.
Yeah, if we were on the cycle we'd kind of held for the past couple generations, he was right. And he goes, and he made a comment like, well, do you really think that Sony's 10-year plan is going to apply everywhere? And I said something along the lines of, well, honestly, I don't even think Sony believed their 10-year plan when they originally said it.
Yeah.
I think they've just sort of gotten lucky that fate has made them honest, even though they never really intended it to be true. Because I think we've reached a point where there's so much beef in the hardware that you can't.
There's so much money put into that hardware, too.
Yeah,
they don't want to develop a new system.
I mean,
right
I guess, I mean, the only caveat attached to the PS3 example is that whereas the 360 has been, you know, pretty successful in its own right, you know, despite obviously trailing Wii, you know, significantly and all that, the PS3 hasn't been. And there comes a point where you say, well, would they want to move on because the PS3 has just failed?
But to make a more expensive system? I mean, that's a terrible business
idea. I think
idea.
It'd be far more likely that you would have maybe a price drop coupled with a rebranding rather than an actual new console.
Yeah.
If they felt that, you know, the PS3 is kind of, you know, failed to make the impact we wanted it to make, you know, maybe you make a slimline model, you drop the price, and you call it something different.
And you bundle the wand in with it.
Yeah, yes, you bundle the wand. But it's still basically the PS3.
Yeah.
It still plays the same games. The development architecture is the same. I guess you can say, basically, the technological arms race as we knew it is over.
See, what I said to him at the time was, I think Nintendo is going to be the next one to come out with the system, even though they have the numbers advantage, simply because it will be cheaper for them to move up than it would be for the other
two. Yeah, you started from a lower position.
It would be substantially less expensive for them to make that jump, and that whatever they make would be completely backwards compatible with the Wii.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think, you know, that's where we are with the games industry right now. There's just, you know, I mean, obviously Nintendo made this argument years ago, and it is true. There's just diminishing returns to escalating, you know, the complexity of the technical aspects and all that.
Well, I think as well, there's been a couple of things where generally the industry has been shown that certain things work that they didn't think worked before. Like the Wii has shown that people really don't care too much about hardware and graphics power and all that stuff, as long as, you know, there's something intriguing there to get them interested, the games are good, all that kind of stuff. Also, the success of games like Guitar Hero has shown that people are actually willing to buy peripherals.
Yeah.
More so than they ever have before, and spend a lot of money on them.
I mean, Activision, I mean, they are betting on that big with stuff like Tony Hawk Ride and all that. You know, I mean, a lot of people would balk at the idea of paying $120 for a skateboarding game, but, you know, they think the market's ready for it. Well, the next question is Steve in Kenosha, Wisconsin, writes, E3 ruined the conduit for me.
Ouch.
Okay, that's not an entirely true statement. E3 showed me that the conduit is, in fact, a good game, and if it had been released prior to E3, I probably would have bought it, but now on the eve of the game's release, I'm faltering on my purchase. You see, E3 was good this year, maybe a little too good. There were so many titles shown coming out this year that now I'm in a bit of a pickle. I could only justify two or maybe three full price titles, and see some of the gorgeous games debuting shortly, the conduit has slipped down my list a bit. My question is, considering the current economic situation, will other Wii owners also come to the same conclusions that I have about the conduit?
He must be talking about other platforms, because there aren't that many Wii games in 2009.
There was some text omitted from this to cut it down, and yeah, it's very clear that he was talking about other platforms. So
yeah,
I mean, but John, I mean, for instance, you're in that position. You've got the other platforms as well. A TYP, you've got a PS3, and James, you've got a 360. So you three are all in that situation. With access to some of these other games that are coming out, you know, has it impacted at all your attitude towards something like The Conduit?
No, not really, because, I mean, are there any other big first-person shooters coming out? Like, right? I don't think so. I can't think of any
what,
big
Wii?
Ones.
Well, period. This is actually kind of a slow year for first-person shooters.
Yeah, I mean, the next big first-person shooter is coming out. I mean, Modern Warfare 2, but that's months away.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, for Wii, you've got Red Steel 2 coming at the end of the year.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Which is a bit
that's
of
a very different
kind of
game.
It is very, very different.
Yeah. so you're saying, yeah, even just across all the platforms, yeah, there's not an overabundance of FPSs, so you're fine with it.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think that the people that have been checking for the conduit, I don't think anything's going to shake them just because the game is kind of unique on the platform. I mean, in terms of where, you know, it is a true to form first person shooter, and so I don't think there's really anything to compete against it right now.
Mm. Well and of course, I mean, as you say, I mean, there's a long time between now and the holidays. I mean, so
It's also kind of unique in that the game has this weird hype to it that I don't think we've seen on a third party game for that system, with maybe the exception of the original Red Steel.
Yeah, there's kind of a can they pull it off sort of mystique around it.
Yeah, I think...
intrigue about
it. Yeah,
I
think people are going to buy that game simply because of the, like, well, it can't really have done this, can it?
Yeah.
Curiosity, you think?
Yeah.
I mean,
yep.
But, I mean, that's where maybe the economic situation comes in terms of, you know, is curiosity enough to get people to part with their money under these circumstances?
Well, I mean, we haven't seen the huge slowdown in gaming that we've seen in other
industries. No, I mean, the sales are that have been, for the last several months, you know, have been down year on year. But the thing is that last year was exceptional because around this time you had GTA, Wii Fit, Mario Kart, Smash Brothers. You know, I mean, as a comparison, it's a tough one to make. So yeah, I mean, I accept. Yeah, I mean, the games have been relatively robust, you know. So I mean, I think I don't think it's gonna hurt it too much. And I think TYP makes a great point. You know, I mean, if you're just a Wii owner like I am, there's not that much other stuff to think about.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some high profile third party titles that are worth thinking about, like, you know, Silent Hill, Dead Space, Resident Evil. You know,
but,
stuff.
But
like
they're all very different.
My advice in general for Steve: don't let yourself be guilted into buying a game. If you want to buy a game, buy it because you want to buy it.
Absolutely.
Not because you feel like, well, if I don't buy it, then the developer may not get the money they need and deserve. Don't do that. Buy the game because you want to buy. Don't worry about like voting with your bucks.
It's
got to be on its own merits for you and for you alone. You know,
I'm fairly confident that if you enjoy first person shooters, you won't be. There's a very low risk of you being terribly disappointed by The Conduit.
Yeah.
Just from my hands-on time with it, I'm not ready to anoint it the best FPS I've ever played, but it has solid fundamentals from what I saw.
Yeah.
And, of course, you got the Wii control, so hopefully, you know, if they're done well, you know, just based on Metroid Prime 3, I mean, I think you could do something, you know, pretty satisfying with that.
Now, James, right. Does The Conduit beat Call of Duty 5? Or Call of Duty, World at War?
World at War, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you think so? Yeah, because that wasn't, you thought that was, you know.
I thought that was an above average title, but that was all I was willing to give it.
Yeah, all right, well, that's pretty interesting. John, you are scheduled to review The Conduit still, are you?
Yes, I am.
Depending on how many copies we get.
Are you planning on reviewing it in a timely manner? Please?
Yes, I will.
Always reviews editor getting out in front, doing his job, always on the clock.
Always on the clock, yeah, right.
This is why the reviews editor is never allowed on the podcast.
Never again.
Your business comes up. So, are you playing?
Yeah, well, John was fine when he was reviewing.
Yeah, because John didn't care. Because John was worse than we were.
Well, I only care because John has a history.
I do have a history.
Yeah, it's true.
I do.
There's what we call red flags. All right, well, we'll move on that. No, this is just the last email. It's not a question, but this is Brian in New Jersey. Right, so on episode 148, when you guys were discussing Nyko's wand, you seem confused over the name comma and why it has a K. Well, it's not supposed to be named after the punctuation mark, but instead a Japanese weapon similar to a scythe. So there you go. I feel better.
It does not look like a scythe.
No, it looks like a comma.
It was probably supposed to be a bit of wordplay. You know,
I knew that they were going for a Japanese word on. I didn't know what the word was, but right. I was like, well, it's still a stupid name.
Well, certainly, but I just feel better that they didn't add a K, you know, in the crisscross sense. You know, I just feel better that we've moved on from that as a society.
But, you know? But it would have been doubly bad. Though,
I still wear my clothes backwards, though, for the record.
Well, we knew that, but that's beside the point. I have to say, I met with the Nyko people at E3, and they seemed legitimately proud of what they've made. So,
good for them.
They better be, because they're giving out these like blow up.
Do you want one of these? No, I don't.
Yeah, well, you're reviewing it, James. You have to tell us whether they have every right to be. Legitimately
it drains
proud
the playing Punch Out. I realize that thing drains batteries like nobody's business. I don't know. I don't know what the hell happened. I've already burned through a whole set of batteries on that thing.
Well, that's going to do it for Listener Mail this week. A really good bunch of questions. As always, if you have more questions, comments, or corrections, send those into rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Okay, and now we'll move on to the second part of Retroactive number 6 for Zelda 2 The Adventure of Link. And we've got two people that didn't discuss it with us a couple of weeks back, with John and TYP. So, John, I guess we've got something of an inkling of your feelings towards this game from previous comments that have been made. So, would you like to give us the full detail on your feelings towards it?
Well, I mean, I played it briefly, and it was kind of mixed for me. I didn't have the nauseating retching that I thought I would have. but it was actually, you know, part of it. I mean, back when I did play this game, you know, I did actually, you know, enjoy it, you know, when I played it the first time through way back in the day when it first came out.
And did you, I mean, how much did you get through back then? I mean,
I played through the whole thing. I mean, like, I beat it. That was...
So even though, you know, you harbor this sort of full resentment towards it, you did play all the way through. Is that why you resent it so much?
Well, the thing is, it's what I remembered. You know, I maybe played it for, I mean, I didn't have much time to really even touch it, but I played for maybe an hour. And what I remembered, I was like, wow, yeah, I forgot how controller throwing difficult this game can be. Just because of the way, like, the way it strips experience from you if you get hit.
Yeah, well, not always.
Certain enemies take it away from you.
You know, and the way, you know, some enemies kind of give you the experience points, some don't. Some give you a lot, some give you a little.
Some give you give you trivial in the overworld and things like that. Yeah. So,
yeah.
In terms of how it handles experience points, because it does it so differently, you know, that is kind of, to me, I think, kind of will be sort of intrinsically frustrating to start with while you sort of get used to its own sort of conventions. TYP, we've referenced some of your thoughts on the game from the forum thread before, but it'd be nice just to give us the full sort of extent of your experience with the game, past and present.
Since I posted in the forums and I knew I was going to be on this podcast, I busted out my GameCube Zelda Collector's Disc.
Right.
And yes, I played this with a crappy GameCube D-pad for a long time. And I still enjoyed it, damn it. But in spite of the thumb hurting. One thing I was surprised by, I hadn't played it in several years, and after I'd read some comments, I realized... as a kid, I played this game very, very conservatively.
Mm.
And maybe it's because my first time playing it, I got to like near the end and I had 666 for my levels and I wasn't able to do much. I just felt like I was underpowered, which you are if that's what you have at the end. So every time I'd played it since then, I grind for a long time in either the first or the second temple. And usually I grind on the bubbles because they regenerate.
Yeah, they yield quite a lot, don't they?
And I still do recommend doing at least a little bit in the first dungeon just to make the game more manageable. But this time I kind of made an effort to try not doing that so much. Maybe I grinded to 333 or something in the first dungeon. And there actually are a lot of ways to get points. Now, if you die a lot, it can be hard. But this game is part of my childhood. For those who don't realize, in my avatar, I have Shadow Link behind me in my icon. So this is, you know, one of the games, not necessarily my favorite game, but one of these games that sort of I vividly remember from my childhood. And so for me, when I'm replaying it, all these issues what do I do next? Where do I go next? Those aren't issues for me anymore. I just sort of instinctually know what to do. Now, I took a critical eye to it, and there are definitely things I did not remember about the translation. It is a pretty bad translation.
yes, it
pretty
is.
Pretty bad being an understatement.
I am error.
So here's some notes here. First off, Link talks, and that threw me off guard. He talks, and he's like, oh, I found a mirror. And that kind of like, whoa. You know, when I saw that, and there are some times when it's kind of ambiguous. You already talked about the East versus West, whatever issue it was. But later, there's a part where you have to get some water for a lady to learn a spell, which is, you know, it's a nice idea. But when you go to the fountain, and by the way, you have to talk to inanimate objects, which is also kind of weird. But when you go to the fountain and you talk to the fountain, it says, "Want some water?" That was what it wrote. So. It isn't clear that you actually got water. It's saying, oh, do you want some water? So it's like, oh, yes, I do. Let me go find a bucket, you know? So I could see someone playing this game and like, oh, geez, I need to find the water. You know, how do I get this water? And you know, until they by chance talk to that woman again and realize, oh, I already have water. They're kind of screwed. So there are a couple of little design issues there in the towns, but I like the ideas behind it. I like what they were trying to do. They were clearly constrained in the English version by like one box of text.
How much you could put, the amount of text
they were cutting out, you know, they were not complete sentences. They were just trying to get ideas out there. And it seems to me like it was not a issue of not understanding the language as much as just cramming the info in there. Punctuation.
I mean, even if it were translated well, when you've got to hack and slash it down to that text box, you know.
Exactly. Largely that was the issue with some of this stuff.
Yeah, I could totally see that. No doubt about that. So, about the difficulty of the game early on, we've got a forum post here from Yoshi1001. Posted, the basic problem with the leveling mechanic is that after the major gains that come with the first few levels, the later boosts become less than useful. As a result, the hardest parts are the beginning of the game, when you're not very powerful and extremely vulnerable, and the end of the game, where your levels don't improve enough to match the sharply increasing difficulty. Now, in my experience, like the bit about the start of the game is true. You know, like it does seem, you know, sort of harder to start with, and then you kind of get over a bit of a hump, especially, I guess, if you did what you were recommending TYP with grinding away at those bubble things for a little while.
Yeah, you can get at least your attack up some, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's sound advice. But, I mean, I haven't got right towards the end of the game, but, is that accurate that, you know, once you get to that very end, it really does?
There's this march up to the final temple that is, I guess there's some caves, there's a lot of, like, these, you know, special squares that when you land on them, you go into this special, you know, combative area. There's a lot of that. And to be honest, as a kid, I gamed it. There's a exploit, which you guys didn't mention last week, that as a kid I discovered pretty quickly, where if you start walking over to one of these special squares, but you get hit by an enemy on the map, you enter the normal enemy sequence, and when you're done, you're on that new square. So you can essentially bypass. I almost feel like I'm justified in doing this, especially for like sections with those damn bubbles that pop up.
The evil bubbles.
I gotta conserve my lives here. I don't care if I'm kind of cheat gaming the game. I don't care. You know, it's in the game, and they haven't taken it out. The game is definitely very difficult. And the final temple is very difficult too. I have not gotten there on my recent playthrough yet, but I mean, I played the game several times. It's a very difficult temple.
Well, and there is actually a kind of special change that happens at the very end of the game, where in fact you do restart at that temple if you run out of lives.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So Nintendo clearly knew that. Yeah, like getting to the temple, at least the designers intended for that to be a big challenge in and of itself. And you can bypass it to some extent through that exploit I talked about. But, I mean, Nintendo knew that this was difficult when they were making this game. And I think that's an interesting point in the game design. I think Adidad has a post that kind of touches on the game design and how it's kind of focused differently than the other Zelda games.
It's almost more like a Super Mario game to me.
Yeah. Like Zelda 2 is bound by its lack of items and reliance on combat instead of environmental puzzles. His point is, it deserves praise because it did something different, and it actually is fun. And I agree, the difficulty is fun. I think the controls are spot on. I love the controls in this game. I know you guys are complaining a little bit about the length of your sword, but I think it's
that's not really a control
on.
Issue, though.
Yeah, and the graphics are primitive in a way that's good. Like another game I'm playing through here and there is Henry Hatsworth, which you guys have talked about to death.
Plenty.
But I'm kind of a little annoyed with the melee attack, which I use the most, because it's kind of hard to tell if you're going to hit that person or not.
Yeah, you kind of have to do that by experience, it's variable. Like if you do the one where you're crouching and slash, it's like longer. So. Yeah,
exactly.
Could see
so that. So I like the real predictability of when I push A, it's going to do this. If I push up A, it's going to do this. If I push down A, it's going to do this. And it's very fast, and you can get out of your down stab really quickly if you need to, you know. I just think that the controls are, maybe it's because I grew up on it.
No, I don't think there's anything wrong with the controls at all. No. I mean, I think they work fine, and obviously they really have to, because this game, as Adidad was talking about, it does emphasize the combat elements rather than, you know, the item use and the puzzles or of other Zelda games. So it's so leveraged on that. It had to work, and it does. The combat works. I mean, I really feel that it does. I mean, in terms of this, deserve praise because it's different. I mean, I think it just deserves praise because it works. Not
it's
so much
game.
Because it's different.
I like the game.
You know what I mean? And the downstrike, I mean, I think that's a big deal in this game in the sense that it speeds a lot of things up.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it? You know, like once you can start bouncing over the top of enemies, you know, I mean, and Johnny kind of alluded to this last week and stuff, and killing them that way very quickly and stuff, it does improve the flow of the action for me. Mm-hmm. And it's fun as well.
Yeah. Well, so sometimes it's amusing to just sort of tap down really quickly a lot of times. You can like stab them over and over again. I just sort of I don't know if you try doing that, but it can be really amusing and fun way to, you know, if you're not quite high enough above like a bubble to kill it by down stabs, if you do this, you're almost like jumping on the baddie, just down stabbing over and over again. And there's just lots of fun little weird techniques in the game that maybe some of them weren't even intentional, but
yeah.
I don't know. It's just the controls are simple but satisfying, just like in Punch Out. And speaking of Punch Out, it's weird that a lot of us are playing Zelda 2 with Punch Out on GameCube, because on the NES, Punch-Out borrowed a lot of sound effects from Zelda 2.
Like, because that's the thing that reminded me, actually, because the thing about Zelda 2 is that in Japan, it came out at the beginning of 1987, so that would be well before Punch-Out came out,
really?
Wouldn't it?
Wow.
I think the original Zelda was about 11 months before that. So, I mean, this was a really quick turnaround that they got this game out.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. I think if they'd had more time, I think it might have seemed a bit more polished than it does. You know, it has some rough edges, mm-hmm. and, you know, some things that just make it seem like it was perhaps the product of a quick development cycle. But having said that, I'm still kind of impressed, especially considering that it is, as has been mentioned before, quite an ambitious 8-bit game, you know, that they got this done so quickly.
Speaking of the time period that it came out, I was wondering, you know, kind of like with the overworld map and all of that, what games did it take cues from?
Probably Dragon Quest, my guess.
Because that's what I thought.
I don't know the timelines of Dragon Quest, but I mean, you know, when you're talking about the very beginning, you know, literally like January of 87, I mean, you know, the RPG genre, as Johnny mentioned last week, is not the, you know, the established kind of archetype, you know, yet. I think one of the things about it kind of reminds me, and someone sort of referenced this, I think it was Sundilos in a different context, but it does kind of remind me of the NES Metroid in a way, in the sense that it seems like it is very ambitious, and it could almost have done with a 16-bit version where they kind of really tried to do all the things they wanted to do originally, but, you know, because of the restrictions of the format and because they were doing it on a short time schedule, they probably couldn't manage. But, of course, this never happened. It's kind of a shame, really, don't you think, that, you know, this... There's quite a lot of potential that you could do a side-scrolling game in this vein.
Absolutely.
Today, even now, I mean, I guess you've got the modern Castlevanias and all that, but there aren't really that many games that work like this does.
No, not really.
Yeah, I'd say Castlevania is the closest thing, which means a Metroid, I guess.
Especially too. Like with, I think Order of Ecclesia is more close than the others. The way the combat works and things, and the difficulty, it's probably... It's kind of surprising, you know, having played Order of Ecclesia before that, actually, there is quite a few similarities there. But we'll move on to another interesting forum post that we had, and it says, Sudgelos, as I said before, said, "There is one thing that I realised that I missed in this game from other Zelda games, specifically the visual and audio clues that are present in nearly every other Zelda game. Zelda 2 gives you almost no help in finding your way through the temples. The trek through the final palace/temple is absurdly hard, at least by today's standards. I'd forgotten that you had to break a block in the floor just to find a hidden hold. Oddly enough, I think playing the original Metroid when I was younger helped me prepare for this game more than the original Zelda did, because otherwise trying to find hidden passages or holes would probably never have occurred to me."
You know, there's another game that we've talked about on this show that does that to the extreme, which is Mylon's Secret Castle.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Where it's just like, there's no way to beat this game unless you already know how to beat this game.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a game, I remember that. I mean, that game, like, a friend and I tried to play through that when I was young. Way, way back in the dinosaur age, but and there was literally a part where we had no idea how to beat it and could not figure it out, and that game sat there for months until we actually had to buy a magazine like 6 months down the line, and finally, like, we sat there for 6 months trying to find a magazine that would show us how to do that, and we finally found one. That's the only way we beat it.
Wow.
It's crazy.
I mean, I guess what's interesting about what he says, you know, when you think of Zelda, a lot of the time, you know, if there's a crack in the wall, or if you tap it with your sword, it
sounds
different.
There's a cue of some kind.
That means you can bomb it, for instance, you know.
Yeah.
And what he's talking about here sounds a bit more like, right, I'm going to be Samus and I'm going to morph ball bomb every little bit of this room. Until I find something. I mean, do you think, is that a fair sort of characterization of some of what goes on later on?
I don't think so. I haven't played the final temple in a long time.
Right.
So it's hard for me to speak to that particular example, but I mean, compared with Zelda 1, this has a lot more help, and sometimes the translation screws that up, but I mean, the game is a lot more helpful. You go to the towns and you talk to the people and say, hey, you know, be careful or whatever, make sure to go to the town before you go to the palace. Or, I mean, they give you some hints, and like in one of them, they'll tell you, you know, if you don't know what to do, jump in the pit. They do give you hints. You have to know to talk to people, but they do have hints compared with Zelda 1, where there's just some old guy says, hey, you want to buy a map?
Yeah, it's just a lot more NPCs. Well, it's just the NPCs themselves, really. It's a big step forward, and of course,
yeah.
You know, once you get to the other Zeldas, kind of kept that from Zelda 2. You know,
in Zelda 1, there isn't any clue that you can bomb a wall. You have to bomb every wall.
Really? God, I mean, yeah. It's been a long time since I've touched that, so.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
that's a great design decision.
Zelda 1 has a lot of this stuff in it still. I remember getting stuck. It has a second quest, and I think it was maybe Dungeon 6. I just could not find in the second quest. I just couldn't find it. I went back to it like 8 years later and finally found it. And I was like, yes, I can beat this game again now. I mean, so Zelda 1 had a lot of this, and Zelda 2 did do an admirable job of attempting to fix what problems it could. I suspect there is some really annoying stuff like that, like Sunjul's mentions, but in the grand scheme of things, it was a big step forward, in my opinion.
I mean, it's this sort of, fairly sort of, un-Zelda-ish kind of thing, I guess. I mean, and maybe just because you're not used to doing, what he's talking about in terms of sort of trying to find a little hole in the, break a block in the floor. I mean, there's that red temple, where, there's loads of destructible blocks. Isn't there? But I mean, in terms of a single destructible block in amongst a bunch of ones that you wouldn't necessarily know about, I mean, that isn't something that I've seen when
playing. It does sound vaguely familiar. I'm sure that that's probably the case, and that is kind of asinine. I agree.
these things kind of with 8-bit 8-bit games kind of work quite free. I mean, I have no idea I finished Simon's Quest as a child. If someone could tell me, I'd
you had a lot of time on your hands. That's how you finished it.
Well, you do. That's true.
That's the whole thing. I mean, you have hours and hours to just waste beating your head against the wall.
You were possessed by the game. Mm-hmm. That's the only explanation. There are games that I go back to now from my NES collection. I'm like, how the hell did I beat this?
Or why? Why? That's the question I ask.
Why did I remember this game being this impossible? What the hell?
Am I the only one who still to this day has trouble fighting like the blue enemies in this game? Like the guy that throws the hammer side horizontally?
Or the guy that's like the ones from Castlevania, like the Axemen. Like
I guess so. Blue guys,
I mean, it's pretty much exactly like that. Yeah, I'm impressed for what I've seen. There seems to be, you do find more enemies as it goes. You do get different types, and apparently, even the last temple introduces new enemies, which I think is great because so often when you get to the end of games, it's just the same stuff you've done before. I mean, even in Zelda or in Okami, the very Zelda-like Okami, there's a tradition. There's almost a tradition of fight the bosses you fought before, and stuff like that.
Mega Man syndrome.
Yeah, well, of course, there's Mega Man, the boss gauntlet kind of thing as well. But so seldom when you get to the very end, other than the last boss, is there anything really genuinely new a lot of the time. Whereas here there is. I think that's great because I think it really sort of builds the sense of, that there's something different waiting for you at the end. It kind of helps the momentum of it. I think it's something that's lacking from a lot of games, or at least like other Zelda games.
Yeah, it does. And Mop It Up mentions that like in the final temple, it's more challenge, and the music is different, and it's excellent.
Again, like they made the effort for the last time, actually, because like obviously, I mean, the temple music is really good, but it's used a lot inevitably before that. So yeah, that's really cool. I mean, I think I would like to see very often with Zelda games, you have these really great dungeons, all through the game, and then you get to the last one, and it's kind of not quite as full featured. Like, I mean, you could say that about Ganon's castle in Wind Waker. You could say it about the Hyrule castle in Twilight Princess. I mean, it just always seems to be that way.
I seem to remember the Windfish's egg or whatever it is being kind of short too. Mm.
Yeah, but, it was.
Nintendo wasn't lazy back then. I mean, the original Zelda had a really crazy ass difficult final dungeon for Ganon.
I mean, it doesn't just have to be crazy ass difficult. I just like the feel of that. I want to feel like you're up in the ante right to the end.
Yeah.
The Ganon's castle in the original dungeon, what do you want to call it, in the first Zelda, I think used up every single square in the map. you know, the right. range that you could have.
No, so. it just feels like something that's, you know, I mean, you get loads of great finales, like with the bosses and stuff, but just the bits that lead up to it kind of sometimes, if they feel a little bit flat to me. I picked out what I thought was a pretty interesting transition from someone that's joined the forums especially to contribute to the retroactive thread for Zelda 2, which we always obviously support. That's great. Especially like, you know, as it was when all the E3 craziness was going on. It was really nice to have that kind of level of participation. But this is from Buttle, and he first posted, "I think the biggest thrill is that it's a Zelda game, but it's so different from the others. You've got no one holding your hand telling you anything, which is really refreshing, and the 2D controls, fighting, exploring is great." So, you know, it's all going well. I think he was already quite far into the game at this point.
And then he has his rebuttal.
Very nicely done. So he posted later. He posted later, and I think at this point he had gotten very, very deep into the game and had been using the Wii suspend feature a lot, but not necessarily actually saving, and then find himself stuck in a room that he had apparently no way out of. Just could not find his way out of the room at all. And so he said, "After finding no way out of the room, I reset the game. The last time I saved was a long, long while back, and so with that, I think I'm done."
I can understand.
And then he says, "I do think that this is an awful, awful game."
Well, some of that is self-inflicted.
Yeah.
"There's a little magic here and there, but you've got to go through some major shit to get to it." So I think, you know, that may be frustration talking as much as anything, because that does sound really bloody annoying.
But that's what I'm saying, though, is that there are some parts in this game where I was like, holy shit, I just want to punch my TV.
Well, it's no question. You know? There's no question in my mind, you know, leaving aside the 8-bit, the original 8-bit Zelda, maybe, you know, has its issues. But certainly when you look at subsequent Zeldas, I mean, Zelda 2 is way more frustrating, you know, than any of those. No doubt. I mean, you know, just the very fact that you can, you know, get close to getting a level and then you might just miss a jump. And then that's your life gone, your experience gone, and that's, you know, then that kind of frustration is essentially impossible in subsequent Zelda games. But, you know, it's a double-edged sword, because that's, you know, some of the challenge and the tension in the game as well.
Yeah,
when it works.
I agree. I found that I was really cocky when I first started playing this a couple of days ago, because, like, I played this over and over again, you know, and I was dying, you know, I lost 800,000 whatever points. I mean, I was maybe 400 points away from an upgrade, and I was on my last life, and, like, you know, I should be playing conservatively. I shouldn't be going to the boss right now to battle him. I should be, you know, trying to level up. But, you know, I'm playing this for my seventh time, you know. So I died, obviously, and you know, and I had to, I said, yeah.
And then Ganon laughed at you, and you thought, you bastard.
But, you know, that isn't for everyone. I mean, I totally understand, especially something like this with a save state problem.
I think there's a couple of different levels to this, in the sense that, number one, it isn't going to give you everything that Zelda, you know, that you would be accustomed to from a Zelda experience. But then the second thing is that even if you kind of wrap your head around that, you still may or may not like what it does do.
It is a creature of its own right. Now, whether or not the design decisions were all good.
Yeah.
And whether the reception is responsible for there not being more games like this, I mean, I don't know.
I mean, I think it sold quite well.
It did sell pretty well, yeah.
I guess, I mean, some of it's just because it's, you know, the time, the game design kind of ethos was still so dominated by the arcade. I mean, even though it didn't necessarily have to be, but it was.
Yep.
I mean, you know, most games were very arcade style. Whereas, you know, this, you know, because it had a live system, you know, you might think it is on the surface of it, but it really isn't. You know, it's very, you know, it's very different from that. So that's why it's this weird kind of mix of sort of, you know, the side scrolling and all that kind of looks arcadey. The lives look arcadey, but it's not an arcadey game at all.
No, it isn't.
Yeah, it's not one of those games where you feel like, oh, this design decision was made to eat quarters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It isn't. The design decision was made to make you be careful.
That's the thing about the difficulty in the game. It's not about that at all, which I think is one of the better things about it, but that doesn't mean it won't frustrate people at the same time.
I really like the magic system, and I know I guess Johnny talked about it a little last time when you talked about Zelda too, but I found that like the resource management involved in, you know, saying, well, see, how much magic do I have left? Should I use shield? Do I need to save it for life later? I mean, I thought that was, I think it's really interesting, and it's something I kind of have taken for granted in prior playthroughs, but I really noticed it this time.
And it's really significant resource management, like, again, more so than there is in other Zelda games, for sure, because,
yeah,
I mean, that
is
very valuable.
If an enemy drops a magic capsule or whatever they call it, looks like a musical note. I have no idea what it really is supposed to be. You're like, okay, well, you know, what can I use right now? You know,
I mean, it could really get you out of a jam.
Mm-hmm.
I want to heal myself a little. I want to do shield. What do I want to do? You know, so it's a really interesting thing that I think has been lost largely in the Zelda series, because they have magic still. It introduced magic.
Yeah,
but
it mostly kind of just powers certain items, doesn't
it?
You know, it's kind of subservient.
There are abilities that you can use magically, and that was really big in Ocarina of Time, not so much in games that preceded it.
Well, I thought that Wind Waker did a decent job just because of the leaf that you fly. That has it there.
True.
But there isn't this sort of trade-off on which what do I want to use my magic for? There really isn't that feeling.
Yeah, there's no tactical application for magic, really.
Yeah, the tactical element is what's so different, because as the EYP said, you know, sometimes it's like you could use it to, say, jump over a bunch of enemies, but obviously if you did that, you'd jump onto a higher ledge and then kind of, you know, avoid them. But of course, doing that, you're not going to kill those enemies and get experience points. You could say, well, do I do that, which is sort of safer? Or do I use the shield so I can stand in there and you know, maybe actually kill these guys and get the experience points? I mean, it is resource management. It is sort of tactical. And that's really interesting in a way that, you know, and as TYP says, like, when you get a refill, that is a big event. Like, it's not that common.
It can make or break you, absolutely.
And the heart and magic containers are big deals in this game. Mm-hmm.
Again, they're really... Whereas, you know, I mean, come on. I mean, in the Link to the Past or any of these other ones that have had a magic meter, I mean, you cut a blade of grass and you're going to be able
to... It's magic grass, fucker.
And in terms of taking it into a boss fight, you can have, like, the blue potion, which fills both, or the green potion.
Potions is really the extent of the asset management in more recent games.
And I mean, if you've got, and I guess that's related to how many bottles you've got in the so there's a little bit of it in subsequent Zeldas, but it's much more important and much more tactical in Zelda 2. And I mean, the one thing I kind of dislike about the way the levels work is that it really behooves you to kind of game the system in certain respects. Like when you do a temple, you get like a level for free, basically, don't you? So what you really want to do is make sure that when you do that, you've just leveled up, because that is really valuable. Like, then you might be getting like practically an entire level for free, and I just think that's a bit too, like, not based on merit, if you know what I mean.
I agree. I mean, I did what someone suggested in the forums one time, is I jump over the statue, I play through the temple again, got the rest of the experience points, and then
That's right, you don't even have to actually put the thing in the statue or whatever and activate that, so that makes it even more exploitable, essentially. So that's a good point, and I just think that kind of disrupts the balance of the way the leveling works a bit. And, you know, I don't know whether that was an oversight or whether they, you know, in some way intended for you to game it, maybe, but I don't think it's all that successful.
So who actually did design it? Who was the head designer on it?
Well, so Miyamoto apparently set the concept, because it's going to be side-scrolling, it's going to have this RPG element, it's going to be about swordplay and all this stuff, but the actual Zelda team, as it were, did not make it, which kind of, you know, doesn't really surprise you when you hear about how quickly it was made.
Yeah, I mean, I'd really like to see, looking back on it, what he thinks of the game.
Yeah, so this was a subject in the forums. People brought up there's this interview from about 2003, around about when Wind Waker was coming out, and someone was interviewing about the Zelda series and said, you know, well, Adventure Link was very different, you know, what was up with that? And he basically said, well, you know, it's my idea, but it's made by someone else. And it, this is the quote. Says, compared to Legend of Zelda, Zelda 2 went exactly as we expected. All games I make usually get better in the development process since good ideas keep coming, but Zelda 2 was sort of a failure. So, in other words, he's throwing those poor buggers that actually made the game under the bus.
Pretty much. Well, so he's saying that there's nobody there to upend the tea table, basically.
Something
effectively.
Like that.
I mean,
that tea table stayed down.
Yeah, but if this is one of his failures, then, man, I mean, I hate to see a catastrophe. I mean,
yeah.
The way he puts it, though, is almost like it isn't. Like, he's not saying it's his failure. It's like, well, the good ideas didn't keep coming because I wasn't working on it. I mean,
yeah. Well, it wasn't a failure, though. The game, I like the game. The game is good. Maybe he means the development process was a failure in that ideas didn't flourish.
You know,
yeah.
I mean,
like
Miyamoto's conception of a failure sometimes is a little at odds with what mine would be. For instance, I'm pretty sure he considers F-Zero GX a failure.
Yeah. I think the whole thing is, I mean, in terms of his involvement with the project, I think that what he objects to is the fact that there are the kind of glaring sort of design issues that we're talking about, where his games, they don't have that. They just really don't.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's probably as simple as, you know, someone higher up the food chain said, look, we want a Zelda sequel on the market at X date.
Yeah.
And that date is not far away, just an FYI.
Yeah, that date is, you know, pretty much a year from when the first one come out. Make it so.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was kind of the first instance of the series being outsourced, in a way.
Well, in a way.
It was still internal, though.
Yeah. It's still internal, but yeah, in terms of, you know, but they did it with Mario 2, as we talked about, the Lost Levels Mario 2.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing. I mean, that was a really quick turnaround. Exactly the same sort of thing, except that was...
The same game.
Exactly. That was much easier to do on a quick turnaround, because you're not creating a whole new game.
You're not creating anything new. You're just rejiggering
the levels. Just a level
pack,
essentially. Yeah.
Well, I feel like we should bring up that Legend of Princess. I mean, people who, you know, I don't remember who originally linked it to me, but I was, you know, in the quotes were, you know, what Zelda 2 should have been. I'm not sure that's fair.
No, I don't think so either.
And I think that the controls there are interesting, but kind of sloppy compared to this game. And I actually, yeah. I like this, you know, Zelda 2's controls a lot more than Legend of Princess. Not that those controls are bad, but I'd love to see another game like this. And I've said it before, I'd say it again. I mean, if they get tired of this DS Phantom Hourglass structure or whatever, or if they're looking for something new on Wii.
It's easy money.
Yeah.
I mean, this could be a very interesting experiment for them. They could do it. Heck, they could do another 2D, you know, do what they did with Wario Land, Shake It. I mean,
I guess the easiest thing to do would be position it as a Zelda spin-off, you know, kind of title, maybe. Let's face it, you know, it's not that sacrosanct anymore after Crossbow Training.
Touché. I'd love to see it on WiiWare. Something like this done on WiiWare.
Well, I mean, we always talk about WiiWare in this regard, and it just doesn't seem to be something they're interested in.
Nintendo doesn't make WiiWare games. So DSiWare,
Skip
maybe.
Does. Skip makes a lot, apparently.
They also made Captain Rainbow.
Yes, they
do.
Yeah,
they did, I know. And on that note, actually, one thing that came out around about E3 in Japan, so slipped in amongst like the Monster Hunter bundle news, is there's going to be a new Chibi-Robo for DS. And it's
really?
Coming out in July in Japan. So...
Sweet.
Chibi-Robo fans, it's good for them that the franchise is still going. Whether we'll get it anywhere else, I guess, is up in the air. I mean, because the original Chibi-Robo DS was like a Walmart exclusive or something, and I don't know how well it sold.
Wonderful.
Oh, but it's at Walmart. Everyone's going to buy it there.
Everyone who likes plugging in robots.
Well, I guess we'll bring it to a close there. Do you want to say anything about the very final boss, Dark Link, from your Avatar, the famous, you know...
Oh, well...
Nice spoiler there, Greg. Jeez.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. I don't have that much to say about Dark Link, or Shadow Link, I guess is his name, Shadow Link. He actually feels a lot like fighting an Iron Knuckle, except, you know, he has your down stab too. And I mean, it's an interesting boss. It's an interesting, you know, it's an appropriate final boss in my opinion, because, you know, the controls are such an integral part of the game, and to have another enemy that has the exact same controls as you, it's a very good, and they were kind of building up to it with all these different other Iron Knuckle guys and these skeletons that can downstab. It's kind of
well, and you know, funnily,
this.
we talked about the similarities between this game maybe and some other games, you know, like the latter day Castlevanias or the or Metroid. I mean, they kind of have done this as well. You know, like you think of the fusion boss with the SAX, or you know, fighting Richter Belmont. I mean, it's almost like the same thing.
I mean, it's an interesting final boss. I'd say it's a little anticlimactic once you beat him. You just sort of, oh, there's the Triforce, and there you go.
you think getting the Triforce would be a more exciting moment than that?
Yeah.
Gee, you've just gotten your hands on the basically embodiment of divine power.
Nope, it's over. Game's over. Bye, guys.
Yeah, he's getting the Triforce of Courage, isn't he? Like, it's only the one piece.
Right.
It's basically the same as what Little Link gets in the Wind Waker, isn't it? It's the same, but he had to fish for it.
Yes. Well, you know, I would much rather fish for the divine embodiment of creation than have to go through a bunch of levels to find it. I mean, yeah. Honestly, it just seems more relaxing.
Yeah. All right, well, that's going to do it for the Zelda 2 Retroactive. I want to say again, as Johnny said, you know, really, really great participation on this occasion. Lots of really good posts, far too many to go into detail with on the show, unfortunately, but really appreciate all the participation and the new people that came in. All it was great, especially, you know, with it having to be protracted over E3 and everything. It was really good. And I'm going to close out the show now, first of all, by saying emails should go to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And a special note on that, next week's episode, as you may have guessed, is episode 150, and we'll be doing some commemorations and so forth for that special anniversary.
Giant slimes and giant bubbles.
So we would appreciate if you've got anything you'd like to hear about, any particular memories you've got of the show or anything. If you're listening to this pretty close to when it went out, you've got a chance to get that in before we record. Send it to us and we may well use it on the show next week. And Johnny will be back for that, I believe. And TYP, thanks a lot for joining us. Help us out with Zelda 2.
Oh, I'm always happy to interject and interrupt you, Greg.
And how are we looking for radio trivia now that you have been re-established?
There should be a new episode up before this gets up.
Great.
They're just pushing on the final touches, so check that out.
And of course, John and James, always a pleasure.
Always a good time.
Oh yeah.
Looking forward to it next week. It's gonna be good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's gonna be fantastic.
It's gonna be the best.
It's gonna be like a bear attack all day.
Yep.
I'm looking forward to it, guys.
Ooga.
And with that, I'll say so long. See you next week.
Later.
Later.
Bye.
John's not recording. This is a salmon floating around his head talking.
It's all a ruse. Salmon arm, eh? Well, no. See, the funniest thing with that is that I'm just like, I, for a second there, when I played the first time, and when I first played Bear Hugger, I was like, okay, let's just see how far they take the whole stereotype. Okay.
They took it to the extreme.
Well, the funny thing was I didn't hear him say a, and I'm like, wow, that's refreshing. You know,
but he drinks maple syrup. Yeah, so what are you gonna say?
But then I played him again.
I'm a hugger, not a fighter. Take off, eh?
And I was just like, "Oh, you stereotypical bastards."